Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, December 15th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. After that, I'll read an article from the Humanity Behind the Headlines section, and then the explainer. After that, we'll do the home forum, and then the monitor's view. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, Defining Corruption Defines Us. This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who's a print editor, and you can email her at haness@csmonitor.com. And she writes, nobody says they are for corruption. Civil liberty groups decry it, politicians rail against it, and journalists pledge to unmask it. This year, young people from Mexico to Madagascar to Nepal have protested corruption, demanding that their leaders stop the practice that Francois Valerian, chair of Transparency International, called a key cause of declining democracy, instability, and human rights violations. But what exactly is corruption, and what can a society do about it? It's a beguilingly complicated question. As scholars Marco Garrido, Marina Zalaznaya, and Nicholas Hoover Wilson write in their upcoming book, A Comparative Historical Society of Corruption, the way that corruption is defined and counters says a lot about a society. One response, they write, is a doubling down on common cultural values and norms, a recommitment to standards of behavior that affirm a shared vision of social order. But there's another response they found, especially when traditionally liberal responses don't seem to work, one that entails a move toward conspiracy theories and us versus them polarization and even autocracy. The Monitor has been exploring this topic with stories about everything from political behavior in Washington to the demands of Generation Z protesters around the world to efforts to track climate finance funds. In this week's magazine, Linda Feldman writes about President Donald Trump's increasing wealth in office, while also noting that his predecessor's relatives came under legal and congressional scrutiny for allegedly leveraging the Biden family name for financial gain. Meanwhile, contributors Juliana Ramazzini and Nelson Rauda Zabla explore a growing autocracy movement in Central America, which some analysts see as connected to increasing frustration about corruption. These stories and the concept of corruption overall are worth contemplation, regardless of where one falls on the political spectrum. We hope you will read them, pause, and ponder. Labeling others as corrupt without thinking deeply about the meaning or brushing off behavior that unfairly benefits the few can have consequences that ripple across nations. As Dr. Wilson explained to me, even before Mr. Trump, the legal understanding of corruption in the United States had taken us from the possibility of enforcing corruption laws against public officials when they appear to have a conflict of interest, to considering corruption only when a cartoonish level of explicit bribery can be proven. That, he says, takes us away from the common sense idea that corruption represents a kind of moral violation that is embedded in a time, place, political system, and economy. And that was the From the Editor column this week written by Stephanie Haynes, who is a print editor. And this week it was entitled, Defining Corruption Defines Us. And now for the cover story. This week it's entitled, As Trump's Power Has Risen, So Has His Wealth. All in Plain Sight. This is written by Linda Feldman, who is a staff writer, and they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. Upholding public trust has long been a central tenet of American democracy. But ethical norms have fallen under President Donald Trump, even as the net worth of him and his family has grown. The White House denies conflicts of interest. Ethics experts disagree. From Washington, when President Donald Trump pardoned billionaire Changpeng Zhao on October 21st, controversy surrounding the cryptocurrency mogul's ties with the Trump family had already been swirling for months. Mr. Zhao, founder and former chief executive of Binance, the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, had served 4 months in prison in 2024 after pleading guilty to violating U.S. regulations against money laundering. The Binance platform had accommodated criminals across the world, according to then-Attorney General Merrick Garland. After serving his time, Mr. Zhao would still benefit from a pardon because of ongoing legal constraints on his business activities. No felon would mind a pardon, he said in a March post on the social platform X, while also saying, "I have had no discussions of a Binance U.S. deal for a pardon." But that same month, a different deal did happen. A sovereign wealth fund from the United Arab Emirates invested $2 billion in Binance, transferring the invested money in the form of a digital coin called USD1. It's a product created and sold by the Trump family's cryptocurrency firm, World Liberty Financial. Coming in the early weeks of President Trump's second term, the influx of money represented a huge vote of confidence in World Liberty and its fledgling coin. It also drew scrutiny from Mr. Trump's critics. They saw the actions as efforts by Mr. Zhao, Binance, and the United Arab Emirates to influence the president to their advantage. Since then, Mr. Zhao, who holds citizenship in Canada, France, and the United Arab Emirates, has received a pardon, and the UAE has won a deal for advanced computer chips. No evidence has emerged of a quid pro quo connection in all these actions, but the events are part of a larger pattern. Money is flowing to Trump family businesses and other Trump-related activities, often coming from entities that stand to benefit when Mr. Trump, as president, treats them favorably. The White House insists there are no conflicts of interest, yet for watchdog groups and many in the general public, the appearances raise questions. What is at stake, according to experts on ethics, are the nation's long-standing norms and guidelines that elected officials and public servants are expected to follow. The founders were very clear about the necessity for public officials to not be making profits on the side, says Robert McGuire, Research Director for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, C-R-E-W. Today, he says, there is a violation of long-established expectations that the president should avoid the appearance of acting in his own financial interest rather than the national interest. The issue is arising for at least two broad reasons. One is an unusually large tide of gifts towards projects such as Mr. Trump's presidential library or his addition of a ballroom to the White House, now underway. The other is that his family remains active in global business activities that stand to benefit the president financially, even though he says he has recused himself from any direct management role. Gifts are triggering alarm bells among some ethics experts who ask what donors might want in return for their contributions. The alarms get louder when the president himself and family appear to benefit financially. Over the past year, cryptocurrency has become much more lucrative as one of those family businesses. A pardon and red flags raised. On May 5th, after the $2 billion Emirati investment deal occurred, two Democratic U.S. senators posted a letter to the acting director of the Office of Government Ethics, Jameson Greer, outlining what they called a matter of urgent ethics and national security implications involving a crypto firm whose founder needs a pardon. "We write to request an urgent inquiry into a billion-dollar business deal involving the state-backed Emirati investment firm MGX, crypto exchange Binance, and World Liberty Financial, or WLF, that is poised to enrich Mr. Trump and his family as well as the family of Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff," said Senators Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Some pieces of context. World Liberty Financial earns interest on the reserve assets that back customers' holdings in the WLF stablecoin, USDI. Sometimes it looks like a one, and sometimes it looks like an I. So the Emirati Fund's investment in Binance also benefits the Trump family, as long as those assets are denominated in WLF's coin. Mr. Witkoff's son, Zach, is a manager of WLF alongside Mr. Trump's sons, Donald Jr. and Eric. Weeks after that letter was sent, Mr. Trump announced that his administration had agreed to create a path for UAE to buy some of the world's most advanced AI semiconductors from American companies. And on October 21st, he pardoned Mr. Zhao. In an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes that aired on November 2nd, Trump played down any relationship with Mr. Zhao, saying he had no idea who the man was. Asked 2 days later about that statement at a White House briefing, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said the president meant that he does not know him personally. When it comes to pardons, the White House takes them with the utmost seriousness, and the president understands the responsibility that he has as president to issue clemency and issue pardons to individuals who are seeking that, Ms. Leavitt continued, citing a very thorough review process for such requests. In a Fox News interview November 7th, Mr. Zhao denied having ties to the Trump family and said he had never met Mr. Trump. Binance's current CEO, Richard Tang, denies that the company promoted a Trump-linked cryptocurrency before Mr. Zhao's pardon. 5 days after the pardon, Binance announced an expanded partnership with World Liberty Financial. Throughout U.S. history, presidents have had their share of ethical scrutiny and scandals. What's remarkable now is a confluence of unusual factors. Mr. Trump is serving as president even as his family remains highly active in a range of U.S. and global businesses. The president repeatedly disregards established norms, an issue that emerged early in Mr. Trump's first term, prompting the director of the Office of Government Ethics to resign at the time. His party, over which he has great sway, controls both houses of Congress. He has dismantled some traditional modes of ethics oversight. Together, these circumstances create what some observers see as an unprecedented opening for potential or actual corruption combined with a projected air of normalcy or normality around whatever actions Mr. Trump takes. The result, as critics see it, is an open door to a pay-to-play presidency. Much of the question-raising activity is happening in plain sight. That is part of the genius of what he does, says Kathleen Clark, a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis, and an expert on government ethics. By doing it out in the open, many people think it can't possibly be corrupt. Yet, in her view, Professor Clark says in an email, the president has effectuated a hostile takeover of the federal government, establishing a corrupt, personalist regime, where government action is determined not by the law, but by what pleases him. Wealth rising with a return to political power. As of November 24th, Forbes estimated that Trump's net worth at about $6.3 billion, more than double where it stood in early 2024, largely a result of growth in the family's crypto ventures. Meanwhile, as in his first term, Mr. Trump has said he's again not taking his presidential salary of $400,000 a year. Crypto isn't the only arena in which public concerns have surfaced about conflicts of interest within the Trump administration. Researchers on the issue say it is often hard to know whether flows of money have resulted in improper influence on U.S. policy. Influences might exist without any overt quid pro quo deal and thus can be hard to trace or prove. Some examples that hint at both the risks and the blurry lines. Trump meme coins. In May, the president held a gala dinner for the biggest buyers of a Trump-branded niche cryptocurrency, meme coins. The highest high roller, billionaire Justin Sun, bought more than $40 million in dollar sign Trump coins. Before and shortly after the 2024 election, Mr. Sun invested $75 million in the Trump family's crypto business, WLF. In February, shortly after Mr. Trump retook office, the Securities and Exchange Commission paused an investigation into Mr. Sun and his companies over allegations of market manipulation. The White House Ballroom. Construction of a 90,000-square-foot, $300 million event space has begun with October's raising of the East Wing. Mr. Trump has long sought such an addition and pledged no public money would go toward the project. That has opened the door to private donors, from major corporations to wealthy individuals to unnamed entities, individuals and companies, who can potentially benefit by currying favor with the president. The White House promised transparency over the ballroom's funding and released a list of donors, though not their donation amounts. But the identities of several donors remain off the record, including some with business before the administration, according to the New York Times. Mr. Trump also hosted a thank you dinner in the White House with some media access for high-dollar supporters. Golden gifts from Switzerland. On November 14th, the Trump administration announced a deal to lower U.S. tariffs against Swiss imports from 39% to 15%. That followed a visit from Swiss business executives on November 4th, bearing gifts for the president, including a Rolex desk clock and a 1 kilogram personalized gold bar, according to news reports. The gifts will go to Mr. Trump's presidential library, White House officials say. A Boeing 747 gift from Qatar. The White House said in May that a luxury jet was a donation to the Department of Defense and will be transferred to Mr. Trump's presidential library after he leaves office. Democrats argue that the gift violates the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits federal office holders from accepting gifts from foreign states. Senate Democrats have tried unsuccessfully to prevent the administration from spending hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to transform the jet into a new Air Force One. They say it's a hugely wasteful effort if the plane is to be retired from federal service in 2029. An overture from Serbia. On November 7th, the Serbian government passed a special law smoothing the way for a roughly $500 million Trump hotel project in Belgrade under a development company run by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. In a June interview with the BBC, Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić voiced support for the proposed hotel and added, "We are ready to build better relations with the U.S. I think that is terribly important for this country." But Mr. Vučić's government has faced its own controversy, public protests against alleged corruption, and outcries against this deal in particular, which involves building a hotel on a historic site. In all, ethics watchdog Crew counts 23 Trump-branded real estate projects outside the U.S. or the United States that are underway during Mr. Trump's current term. As a result, the president's namesake private company, which he still owns and profits from, is free to do business in foreign countries while Trump is in office, a Crew report says. The report argues that this results in massive conflicts between his personal interests and those of the nation he leads. How Trump has reduced ethics guardrails. Democrats are not immune from the appearance of pay to play. During Joe Biden's presidency, his son Hunter Biden and his brothers Frank and James Biden all came under legal scrutiny for allegedly leveraging the family name for financial gain, dating back to Joe Biden's days as vice president. Last year, the GOP-run House Oversight Committee concluded that Biden family members and associates had received more than $27 million from foreign sources as part of a conspiracy to monetize Mr. Biden's Office of Public Trust. After the Oversight Committee released its report, the Biden White House issued a statement rejecting the report's conclusions, calling the impeachment inquiry a failed stunt. Media fact-check articles on the probe found Republicans made false and misleading claims. Regardless, trackers such as Mr. McGuire say the amounts of money flowing currently are unprecedented compared with past administrations of either party. In January, before Mr. Trump's second inauguration, the family business, the Trump Organization, announced that his children would handle daily management of the president's businesses. His investments and assets would remain in a trust also managed by his children. Finance experts say that putting his personal assets in a blind trust, as a number of presidents have done in recent decades, would be difficult for Mr. Trump because his real estate assets would need to be sold to accomplish that. President Trump is the most transparent president of all time and follows all applicable federal and ethics laws, and there are no conflicts of interest. Davis Engel, a White House spokesperson, told the Monitor in a written statement November 7th. Watchdog groups beg to differ. From a government ethics point of view, Mr. Trump has taken us back over 50 years to the Watergate era, where there is distrust that officials at the highest level of government are truly making decisions for the public good as opposed to their own personal profits, says Kedrick Payne, Senior Director of Ethics at the Campaign Legal Center in Washington. Unlike in past modern-era presidencies, including his own first term in the White House, Mr. Trump declined to issue an ethics pledge for his second term. Nor was there an ethics pledge for the transition process that launched when he was elected again last November. After retaking office in January, Mr. Trump also rescinded the ethics rules put in place by Mr. Biden when he was president. Another big shift in the legal landscape: last year's Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity shields U.S. chief executives from prosecution for official acts, which can be defined broadly. The word official had quotes around it. Where the justices will draw the boundaries remains to be seen, but the ruling clearly reduces legal checks on presidential powers. Other ethical and legal guardrails are also gone. At various federal agencies, 29 of 38 inspector general positions are vacant as of October 21st, including the 17 left empty after firings by Mr. Trump in January. In February, the president also fired the Biden-era director of the Office of Government Ethics, a five-year position established in 1978 post-Watergate. The role is meant to prevent conflicts of interest within the executive branch, though the president is largely exempt from OGE oversight. A series of acting OGE directors has been filling the post. What safeguards exist? During Mr. Trump's first term, ethics watchdogs reported that foreign governments and others purchased services from Trump businesses, including hotels, restaurants, and golf courses, arguing that this violated the Constitution's Foreign Emoluments Clause, which bars officials from accepting gifts from foreign governments. After Mr. Trump left office in 2021, the Supreme Court vacated lower rulings as moot. According to a 2023 analysis by Crew, the president made up to $160 million from foreign countries during his first term. And now, with no emoluments cases pending, it remains unclear when or if the public will find out whether such income is legal, says Mr. McGuire, the Crew research director. It's also unclear how or whether the other ways Mr. Trump is making money while serving as president might be checked, including sales of things such as Trump-branded Bibles, sneakers, and cologne. At this point, what, if anything, can serve as a break on what some legal scholars see as unethical presidential behavior? Beyond a president's own moral compass and the tone he or she sets, the two biggest checks are public opinion and Congress, say ethics experts. While voters will always have a mix of issues on their mind, ethics is one of them, as polls attest. Midterm elections for control of Congress are a year away. All right, now we have one graphic, but it takes up an entire page. It's basically a map of the world with circles with numbers in them, indicating some type of Trump real estate. And they are mostly in the Middle East. Imagine that. And I'm going to read what they are. It says, the expanding Trump real estate empire, along with 10 non-U.S. Trump-branded properties that are open, 23 others are in development outside the United States, according to tracking of news reports by Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And that is who provided this information. So, number one, Chateau des Pommiers in Terrace Basis, French Saint Martin. It's open and it's labeled estate. Number two, Trump Tower, Punta del Este, Uruguay. Units delivered in 2025, and that is residential. Number three, Trump International Golf Links and Hotel in Doonbeg, Ireland. It's open. It's hotel and golf. Number four, Trump Turnberry in Turnberry, Scotland. That's open, and it is a hotel and golf. Number 5, Trump International Scotland. In Aberdeen, Scotland, it's open. That's a hotel and golf. Number 6, Trump International Hotel and Trump Tower in Belgrade, Serbia. It's in development, and that is a hotel and residential. Number 7, Trump Tower, Bucharest. In Bucharest, Romania. In development, and that is residential. Number 8, Trump Towers. In Istanbul, it's open. That is residential and commercial. Number 9, Trump Tower Jeddah in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, opening in 2029, and that will be residential. Number 10, Trump Plaza Jeddah in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, that's in development, and that is residential and commercial. Number 11, Trump Tower in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, that is residential, and that is in development. Number 12, unknown name in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, in development, and that is golf. Number 13, Trump International Golf Club in Doha, and that's in Simaisma, Qatar. It's in development, and that's golf and residential. Number 14, Trump International Golf Club, Dubai. That's in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. It's open, and it's golf. Number 15, Trump World Golf Club in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. That's also golf, and that's in development. Number 16, Trump International Hotel and Tower, Dubai, United Arab Emirates, launching development in 2025, and that is hotel and residential. Number 17, Trump International Oman. That's in Muscat, Oman, opening in 2028, and that involves hotel, residential, and golf. Number 18, Trump Tower, Mumbai, in Mumbai, India, and that is residential, and it's open. Number 19, unknown name, it's also residential in Mumbai, India, and it's in development. Number 20, Trump Towers, Pune, in Pune, India, it's open, and that is residential. 21, Trump World Center, Pune, that's in Pune, India, that is commercial, and that's launching development in 2025. Number 22, Trump International Hotel Maldives in Maldives, and that is residential, opening in 2028. Number 23, unknown name in Gurugram, India, in development, and that is residential. Number 24, Trump Towers in Delhi, opening in 2025, and that is residential. Unknown name is number 25 in Noida, India, in development, that's also residential. Number 26, unknown name in Bengaluru, India, in development, that's also residential. Number 27, unknown name, Hyderabad, India, in development, that's also residential. Number 28, Trump Tower, Kolkata, India, that's residential, opening in 2025. Number 29, Trump International Vietnam, from in Hung Yung, Vietnam, opening in 2027, that's a hotel, residential, and golf. Number 30, Trump International Resort and Golf Club in Lido, Indonesia, that's in development, and that is a hotel, residential, and golf. Number 31, Trump International Resort in Bali, Indonesia, in development, that is also a hotel, residential, and golf. And number 32, Trump Tower at Century City in Makati, Philippines. That's open, and that's residential. And last but not least, number 33, Trump World Seoul in South Korea. It's open, and that's residential. And a source, again, is the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And Jacob Turcott is a staff employee for the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, and he compiled all that. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg in on Sunsounds of Arizona. And now for an article in the Humanity Behind the Headlines section, and this one is entitled, Drones Are Changing How Wars Are Fought. The U.S. is trying to catch up. And there is that paragraph here, why we wrote this. America's military leaders are having to think strategically about how to use drones and prepare soldiers for a new era that will require them to be creative, tech-savvy problem solvers on the battlefield. This is written by Anna Maureen Grobe, who is a staff writer. The U.S. Army is keeping a close eye on the battlefields of Ukraine and learning what many officers consider the war's biggest lesson, how drones are changing the way American soldiers will fight. So far, the military has been slow to acknowledge and mobilize for this revolution, top commanders say. Part of the delay is a result of the head-spinning pace at which drone technology has advanced over the last decade, from basic aerial devices to complex machines with AI-powered navigation, long flight times, and advanced cameras. We're behind. I'll just be candid. I think we know we're behind, Lieutenant General Charles Costanza, who leads U.S. forces deployed to Europe's eastern flank, told an audience at an army convention in October. We aren't moving fast enough. Small, inexpensive drones have become incredibly effective at taking out big, costly military equipment, lending urgency to the military's efforts. Shortly after Russia's 2022 invasion, for example, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was pleading for U.S. tanks. He got some. Now they've been essentially put out of commission by drones. The U.S. Army's plan is to catch up by dramatically expanding its arsenal of drones and training its forces in the most effective ways to use them. The service will go from buying roughly 50,000 drones a year to more than 1 million annually by 2028. Army Secretary Daniel Driscoll said last month. He and the Army's top military officer, General Randy George, visited Kyiv on November 19th, in part to discuss ways to end the war. But they also sought to check out Ukraine's drone program, which Mr. Driscoll has called an incredible treasure trove of information for future warfare and a model for the U.S. military. Russia and Ukraine each make roughly 4 million drones each year, and China likely produces triple that, defense officials say. The U.S., meanwhile, produces fewer than 100,000 drones, about half of those for military purposes, across some 500 American manufacturers, including Boeing and Northrop Grumman. The Army has also launched a public-private pilot program called Sky Foundry to speed up the creation of less expensive flying robots, in part by turning existing Army depots into specialized manufacturing hubs where the service can better control costs and scale rather than relying on contractors alone. Commanders say American soldiers need more small, cheap drones to practice with because they are often destroyed during training through design flaws, human mistakes, or part of war game ambushes. But many current drone models cost thousands of dollars. Push for manufacturing and user training. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth called drones the biggest battlefield innovation in a generation in a memo ordering a reimagining of the way the U.S. military uses them. The Pentagon's goal now, he said, will be unleashing the combined potential of American manufacturing and warfighter ingenuity. By next year, unmanned systems will be part of an all-combat training, he added, including force-on-force drone wars. In the weeks after the July memo, the Army launched exercises to start getting more drones into the hands of soldiers in the field. In the past, one big impediment to doing this has been the cost of drones that are highly likely to be destroyed during training. The price tag for each one ranged from $2,500 to $11,000. After the Defense Secretary's memo, it was game on, General McIntosh added at an Association of the U.S. Army convention in October. With the new focus on deploying faster, cheaper drones for the Army's training exercises, the cost has since dropped to about $740 each. This attributable systems, as the Army likes to call them, can be made with cheaper materials than high-end reusable drones. They also tend to be more autonomous, reducing the need for complex control systems. Now, during drills, defense contractors stand by to make tweaks to designs as soldiers break, fine-tune, and fix their drones, said Colonel Donald Neal, commander of the 2nd Cavalry Regiment, at the same Army convention. That's the goal, he says. Encouraging interest in new jobs. The Army is still working out just how to delegate its forces for drone operations since, at the moment, It involves skill sets that maybe we don't have throughout our work, our force, in a very formal way, Colonel Neal said. For now, the Army is creating new job specialties, courses, and exercises in which troops are learning how to integrate drones into military strategy, and where defense companies are learning how to weave troops' tips into quick design tweaks as they go. The aim is to better prepare soldiers for a new era that will require them to be creative and, in some cases, tech-savvy problem solvers on the battlefield. War does that, General Costanza said. It forces you to be innovative. The Army is also relying on troops who have passion and a tenacity to learn, he added. They watch YouTube videos and build their own drones. Commanders support them by buying 3D printers, which create three-dimensional objects from digital files by layering and fusing materials. To encourage and formalize this troop interest, the Army has also created a new Military Occupational Specialty, or MOS, in Pentagon parlance, just for drone operators. That means new schooling, including the Unmanned Advanced Lethality Course, a name that contains one of Mr. Hegseth's favorite military words. This three-week class includes 24 hours of combined simulator time for each student, as well as practice with first-person view, or FPV, drones, now ubiquitous on Ukraine's front lines. So far, the course is teaching about 30 soldiers at a time, but the plan is for other units to build their own drone training programs as well. One of the Army's biggest challenges remains the intense concentration and labor required to operate FPV drones in particular. Troops need to be so focused as they maneuver them that it's don't talk to that soldier, don't nudge that soldier, don't ask them to make a radio call, and they probably aren't carrying a weapon, General McIntosh said. So, while it takes one person actually to operate a drone, it takes another to handle security, another to carry equipment, and one more to set up antennas. A 4 soldiers to 1 drone ratio, he said. That's the wrong math. Commanders like to stress the need for speed by frequently citing the cookie test. Some factories in Ukraine, as the story goes, put a fresh cookie in a drone off the assembly line. Once the baked good goes stale, the drone isn't capable anymore because the technology has changed so quickly, General Costanza said. He admitted the story might be apocryphal. The point, he added, is that drone evolution moves really, really fast, and the U.S. Army must, too. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. It is entitled, When Jerry Met a Salamander, the 1812 Roots of Today's Gerrymandering Battles. And they do have that paragraph why we wrote this. Attempts to control the drawing of congressional districts to benefit a party or candidate stretch back to nearly the country's founding. This year's spurt of redistricting has cast renewed interest in what gerrymandering is and how it works. This is written by Victoria Hoffman, who is a staff writer. When John Adams wrote in 1776 of his vision for a representative assembly to make laws for the emerging republic, he declared it should be in miniature, an exact portrait of the people at large. How exactly to pick the people's representatives for the United States elected body, Congress, has been a matter of debate nearly ever since. One founder, James Madison, almost lost his spot in the first Congress because of a rival's hand in designing Madison's district. Today, the redrawing of congressional maps to favor a particular party or candidate, known as gerrymandering, dominates the political landscape. President Donald Trump kicked off the current partisan battles by encouraging allies and state legislatures to rework maps ahead of the typical redistricting schedule in order to favor Republicans, sparking counter-efforts among Democratic lawmakers. Gerrymandering is expected to remain in the spotlight as redistricting efforts face court challenges and as politicians maneuver to position their parties ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. On November 18, a panel of federal judges blocked the new congressional maps Texas drew in August, saying they were racially gerrymandered. Unlike partisan gerrymandering, redistricting along racial lines is illegal. The state of Texas has appealed to the Supreme Court, and the High Court will rule this term on a separate case that could result in significant partisan redistricting if a key provision of the Voting Rights Act is struck down. A lawsuit is also challenging California's new congressional maps. Voters in November temporarily suspended the state's independent redistricting commission in favor of new maps to add 5 Democratic House seats to the state's delegation. The Justice Department claims the new districts are based on race. Mr. Trump continues to urge state-level Republicans to redo their maps. In mid-November, he harshly criticized GOP lawmakers in Indiana who dropped their redistricting effort. 6 states have changed their congressional maps this year, and at least 7 others have considered doing it, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, which notes that states have been redistricting this year at rates not seen since the 1800s. Here's the history behind the centuries-old practice, how it works, and why it remains a contentious part of U.S. politics. And what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: what are the origins of gerrymandering? Answer: the term gerrymandering originated in Massachusetts in 1812. The governor at the time, Elbridge Gerry, signed a bill allowing for the redrawing of the state's voting districts as a means to ensure his party, the Democratic Republicans, maintained their power in future elections. The Boston Gazette coined the term, pairing the governor's last name with criticism that the new and oddly drawn districts resembled a salamander. Gerry did not win re-election that year. However, his manipulation of the map allowed the Democratic Republicans to win 29 out of 40 seats in the legislature. Though gerrymandering and redistricting are similar, the two are distinct. Redistricting is required every decade by Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution to ensure that congressional districts are aligned with population shifts. Gerrymandering is a form of redistricting with the intention of benefiting one candidate or party. Question: how has gerrymandering been used? Answer: there are 2 main methods by which gerrymandering can aid in swinging an election: packing and cracking. Packing is when supporters of a party or an individual politician are concentrated into a centralized area. Cracking is when voters are scattered across multiple districts to thin out the opposing party's influence. After the Civil War and passage of the 15th Amendment guaranteeing black men the right to vote, an aggressive era of gerrymandering began. In southern states, it became a tactic of racial oppression, until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 prohibited states from discriminating by race during redistricting. Other prominent examples of gerrymandering include a 1990s redrawing of North Carolina's 12th congressional district, known as the I-85 district, for its line that nearly exactly paralleled the interstate highway, and Maryland's 3rd district, which in the 2010s was nicknamed the Praying Mantis. In recent decades, progress in technology has created new methods for state lawmakers to pinpoint lines based on voting data and mapping software after generating thousands of potential maps. The computer has become integral to the gerrymander, says Nancy Beck Young, a historian at the University of Houston. And the final question: what efforts have been made to counter gerrymandering? And the final answer is a long one. While most states leave redistricting in the hands of politicians, some have made efforts to move control of the process into more neutral hands. In 2000, Arizona was one of the first states to create an independent citizen commission to aid in redrawing state legislative districts. Today, 7 states use such commissions for congressional redistricting, with California's temporarily paused, according to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Before those efforts, a series of Supreme Court cases rolled out in the 1960s had begun cracking down on gerrymandering in what was called the reapportionment revolution. The landmark 1962 decision in Baker v. Carr allowed federal courts to intervene in state appointment disputes. That was followed in 1964 by Westbury v. Sanders, which established that congressional districts must be drawn with roughly equal populations, putting forth the phrase, one person, one vote. That same year, Reynolds v. Sims mandated that state legislatures must be proportional in population. The Voting Rights Act has been successfully used in efforts to challenge gerrymandering, such as in 1984, when a panel of federal judges ruled North Carolina's redistricting process discriminated against black voters. The heart of the Voting Rights Act, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, was Section 5, which stipulated that certain jurisdictions must get their proposed voter changes approved by the Justice Department or the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, and ensured changes were non-discriminatory. Section 5 and part of Section 4 of the law were struck down by the Supreme Court in its 2013 Shelby County v. Holder decision. The ruling effectively ended the federal pre-approval process for states proposing jurisdiction plans that could be challenged as being discriminatory. Building upon the legal framework from that ruling, the Supreme Court is set to decide on Louisiana v. Calais by June. If justices decide the case earlier in the term, it could set off a scramble as states race to redistrict before the midterm elections. The case targets Section 2, which is the primary facet of the Voting Rights Act that protects minorities following the court's 2013 decision, as it bans election rules or practices that could deny or limit voting rights of minorities. After the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Louisiana v. Calais in October, many court observers expect the justices to narrow Section 2. The government argues that the Voting Rights Act was not meant to continue indefinitely and that use of race in gerrymandering runs afoul of the 14th and 15th Amendments. In regard to partisan gerrymandering, the Supreme Court's 2019 decision in Rucho v. Common Cause held that federal courts can't review partisan gerrymandering claims, leaving it to the states to decide. And now for the home forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article, and I will read it. It's entitled, "The Gift of No Big Gift. The year I thought Christmas would be ruined was when I learned its true meaning." This is written by Charles Davis. "Daddy and I won't be able to give you a big present this year," my mother said quietly. "But why?" I asked, wondering what I'd managed to do in the last couple of weeks that had landed me in such hot water. "We just can't afford to buy your corrective shoes and an expensive gift this year. I'm sorry, honey," she said, pulling me to her. You'll still have lots of things under the tree," she reassured me, ruffling my hair. The shoes in question were big-budget brown high-top horrors. They were meant to keep my arches supported and my toes pointed in the right direction. I had to wear them as long as I could remember. Stung by this loss, I felt as if I'd swallowed a large rock that was quickly plunging to the pit of my stomach. While both my parents were incredibly hard workers, we were never flush, and the economies were necessary. Fortunately, my parents weigh with a penny, and their ability to build paint, glue, tack, spackle, caulk, and sew anything meant that we kids were rarely aware of this. As the oldest of four, I was taught that it was my job to hang tough in the face of disappointment. Nonetheless, I took every opportunity to plaster on a long face whenever I happened to be within 10 feet of Mama during the first couple of days after hearing the terrible news. Then, hoping that guilt might do the trick, I decided to soldier on bravely. But no matter what I tried, nothing worked. Crushed, I was sure my Christmas was ruined. But as the holidays drew closer, I started to realize the season was still magical. Mama wrapped presents and stacked them in the corner of the living room so my brother, sisters, and I could try to guess what was inside, a tradition I begged her to follow every year. Boxes and bags of unknown origin were hidden under coats and rushed to the bedroom for wrapping long before a Douglas fir spread its branches in the corner of the living room. Twinkly lights framed windows and festive tunes floated through the house. The sweet, spicy scent of gingerbread cream cheese cookies studded with maraschino cherries and my mother's famous stolen bread hung tantalizing in the air. When Christmas Day arrived, a part of me still wished that Mama had been wrong and a costly gift with my name on it was hidden somewhere under the tree. There was none. The truth is, I was hopelessly sorry for myself at first. But as the day wore on, a part of me felt fortunate fortunate to be the recipient of a sea of small presents now buried in abandoned wrapping paper. Fortunate to be safe and warm in our creaky old house. Fortunate to be embraced by the love of my noisy, imperfect family. I forgot my disappointment in the rush of returning to school, but I'll never forget coming home about a week later to find a cardboard box the size of a small house filling our living room. "Open it, Chucky," Mom said, gesturing towards the huge thing. "It's your big present." "It's from your grandpa, grandma, daddy, and me. We ordered it weeks ago, but when we found out it wouldn't make it here by Christmas, I came with that crazy story about only having enough money to buy your corrective shoes," she explained. "I'm sorry you were disappointed, but I couldn't figure out another way to explain things without spoiling the surprise." My brother, sisters, and the pack of kids my mother always babysat clustered around the mammoth cardboard structure, jumping up and down besides themselves with excitement. Overwhelmed by my family's generosity in the face of my sulkiness, I burst into tears. Unsteadily, I opened the box. Inside was a gleaming, brand new bicycle just for me. Tracing a finger over the shiny new handlebars, I ran to my mother and gave her a giant hug. "Merry Christmas, Chucky," she said. Looking back on that long-ago holiday, I realized the disappointment of thinking I wasn't getting a big gift was, in fact, a gift. I got my first glimpse of the true meaning of Christmas that year. It helped me realize that the holiday wasn't just about what was under the tree, but about sharing the joy of the season with the people I loved. And finally, we're at the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are two of them, and I might not be able to get the second one complete. But here we go. Extracting Minerals in Africa for Africa. In November, top leaders of Africa and Europe gathered in Angola in an attempt to answer this question. Can ethical business practices win out in the global race to extract Africa's vast mineral resources? The moral tone for the summit was set earlier by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. In a speech, she said Europe seeks critical materials for its China-challenged industries, but not just for Europe's needs, but with local processing and added value in Africa. In other words, can European mining companies help Africa process its raw minerals into consumer and industrial goods while also boosting local jobs and local skills? For some countries in Europe, that would mean a shift away from how it often treats former colonies. As President Faustin Archange Touadéra of the Central African Republic put it in September, "The era of Africa's dependence is over." He called for sovereignty, not subordination, partnership, not exploitation. With the global contest for green minerals picking up speed, the dynamics for Africa are in its favor. Economic exchanges for a long time happened in a colonial relationship, but I believe that with the overall shift in global geopolitics, we now have a relationship that is more on an equal footing, less paternalistic. Pascal Saint-Amans, a professor at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland, told Radio France Internationale. A good example, and the reason for the summit being held in Angola, is a rail project funded by the EU and the United States that would speed up transportation from Africa's mineral heartland in Zambia and the Democratic Republic of Congo to Angola's Atlantic coast. If the European Union and its African partners can show mutual benefits from building the Lobito Corridor, as the project is called, it would be a model for all of Africa and its external partners. Together, Africa and Europe can lead the way, Ms. von der Leyen and European Council President Antonio Costa said in a statement. The two blocs can shape a fairer, greener, and more secure world based on shared values and mutual respect. Much still needs to be done to achieve such goals. Investment must move from PowerPoint to the factory floor. Ekemiset Efoyong of the Nigeria-based consultancy SBM Intelligence told Agence France-Presse. Yet the EU has at least embraced a role as an ethical partner, aiming to lift resource-rich countries as much as it lifts itself. The next Monitor's View article is entitled Uplift in a Stable Home and Family. The end-of-year holidays that bring people together can sometimes put a focus on patterns of marriage and family. This year, the outlook for both institutions is positive in the United States, according to recent surveys. Despite shifting norms, most U.S. adults still see marriage as a meaningful foundation for family life and child rearing, the Barna Group reported in November. And 81% of Generation Z respondents said it believe in marriage and hope to wed someday, though many are reimagining what family looks like. Divorce is down, as is single parenthood, and the share of kids being raised in stable married families is ticking up, researchers wrote in a July article by the American Enterprise Institute. Marital stability looks much different than it did 30 years ago, these authors noted in another blog, yet new marriages are stronger today than every decade since the 1950s. This bodes well for families and for children. Children simply do better if they have married parents, according to New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. However, education and economics do play a role. For children of college-educated parents, 81% live with both parents. That drops to about 50% for children of parents with a high school education or less. The Georgia Center for Opportunity stated, two-parent households provide a significant privilege for children, leading to better educational and economic outcomes and lower rates of incarceration. Harvard University anthropologist Joseph Heinrich has concluded much the same about the security and nurturing power of a stable marriage and home. In many ways, marriage represents the keystone institution for most, though not all, societies and may be the most primeval of human institutions, he has written. Surveys find that family and family time score the highest among several values that Americans hold dear. In 2023, Pew reported 73% of American adults ranked family time as one of the most important aspects of life. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.